Kind of had that tendency in April to kind of go to sleep for a week or two, and it cost us dearly a couple times in terms of home court advantage and division title, like you said.
At that point, the Jazz said, okay, this is where we got to prove if we're real. This is where we have to prove if we're, you know, if we're kind of a joke.
The jury in the Rodney King case has delivered its verdict, and not one of the four police officers seen on videotape beating Mr. King a year ago is guilty of using excessive force. They've all been found not guilty.
Well, that's the most incredible experience ever.
I thought, this is where I die, and there was no helicopter flying above to you know, film me getting drug out of the car and beaten to death. And we didn't have cell phones back then, and I just thought, my wife's not going to know what happened to me. Station's not going to know. Kurt's not going to know. I'm going to die here. I'm going to die here.
It's episode 4 of the 1991-92 Utah Jazz season, the most pivotal of them all. Hello and welcome to day 4 of the 1991-92 Utah Jazz season, the most pivotal of them all. On today's episode, we'll take you through the stretch run to see whether the Jazz can finally break through and win the Midwest Division and get over those April struggles. And we'll take you to an interrupted playoff series in Los Angeles and a story from nearly 30 years ago that feels like yesterday. I'm David Locke. Thank you for taking the time. Two seasons prior, the Utah Jazz had lost 3 of 4 and 4 of 6 down the stretch, including a loss to the Spurs on the final night of the year to lose the division by one. And the year prior to 1991-92 and 90-91, the Jazz would seemingly be about to get over the hump. They've won 6 of 7 to get in position to win the division. And the final night of the year, they would lose to the Golden State Warriors and lose the division by a game, dropping from the 2 seed to the 5 seed, because in 1991-92, when you won the division, you were guaranteed the number 2 seed. So as the Jazz started down the home stretch of that season, and the nervousness of years past failures was prevalent, they headed into a game that Karl Malone called, quite simply, the biggest game so far. And Jeff Malone said, you can't get to the point where hanging at altitude is life or death, but this one is pretty close. The Jazz would play the San Antonio Spurs with a 3-game lead. It would be on the back end of a back-to-back after the Jazz's huge win over the then number 1 seed Golden State Warriors behind those 44 points of Karl Malone. So here came the Spurs, and it was the 4th of March. Just enough time to run away with it. Frankly, just enough time to blow it again. And once again, to remind us how the eras are a bit different, it was an 8 o'clock tip in Salt Lake City to accommodate San Antonio TV. But think about that for just a moment. To accommodate San Antonio TV so the game could air at 9 o'clock at night in San Antonio. In other words, they couldn't get the game on in prime time in San Antonio. Instead, they need to push it back far enough so they could find an open window where someone would be willing to air the game. And in 1991-92, that was still for a local broadcast to push it back to 9 o'clock. This was the 3rd meeting of the year. The Jazz had won the first two, but by just 3 points. But for the Jazz to win this game against the Spurs would mean they had won the season series. Jeff Malone was on fire earlier. The Spurs had an injury, so Vinnie Johnson had to come off the bench and start. And Jeff Malone torched him for 12 first quarter points. The Jazz would lead at 26-21 at the end of one, jump to a 66-52 lead, and the Jazz were rolling. The Spurs rallied on a 24-8 run, and all of a sudden it was 76-74 heading to the fourth quarter, and the nervousness would start again. But as Jerry Sloan said, Mike Brown came in, and especially in the second half, was terrific. He hit some big shots. His defense on Robinson was very good. Asked about it by Mike Brown about David Robinson. He's one of the best shot blockers in the league. I'm not a great leaper like Blue or David Benoit. The shot they gave me the night, I had to take and make. And those were back-to-back 17-footers. And with the Jazz win, the division lead was to 4 games with 21 left because of Mike Brown, the Brown Bears. 17 points, 6 rebounds, and 2 blocks. For all intents and purposes, it felt like the division race was over, but Spurs coach Bob Bass had one of the more bizarre quotes. Anything could happen. Carl Malone could get the measles. If Carl gets the measles and he's out 2 weeks, we could catch them. Who knows? He might get the measles or the chicken pox or something. Remember the mailman talking at the free throw line? Well, the mailman had hit 64 of his last 69 free throws. And at one point, he even hit 27 consecutive free throws. So all seemed like it was perfect in Jazz world. And yet, the next night, the Jazz blew out the Nets, but Blue Edwards explodes. Not in a good way, in a bad way. 3 minutes into the third quarter, Jerry Sloan and Blue Edwards get into a shouting match on the bench. Sloan benches Edwards for poor defense on then-Net player Chris Morris. And Sloan had something to say, and Blue went back at him, and then Sloan got in Blue's face. And it kind of kept being little stories like this that would percolate. The Jazz would go down to Texas a few weeks later and lose both ballgames. One to San Antonio, one to Houston. And when they got back for practice that day, Jerry Sloan would end practice right as it starts. He brought the team together, chewed them out, stomped out of the gym, and the Jazz had to practice by themselves. Mike Brown said Jerry left because he was bothered by the way we played in two big games. Basically, he wanted to see how much we cared. Jeff Malone said, I'm glad we stayed and practiced and got something accomplished. We'll bounce back. We dropped a couple of games. We've got 16 left, and we're still in first place. There's no need to panic. And Karl Malone said, I got nothing to say about it. Earlier in March, Jeff Malone had been upset. After a game against Phoenix, in which the Jazz lost, he said, I got into a good rhythm in the third quarter, but coming back in the fourth, I didn't touch the ball. That's disappointing. I was feeling great, and when you feel like that, you want to touch the ball. It's frustrating. And the mailman wasn't without an occasional controversy as well. In what was a blowout win against the Suns with about 9 games left in the season, the mailman had had back-to-back not very good games. In April, he only had 10 points at Portland. And then the next night, he started the night 0-for-5, so Jerry sat him. After the game, Malone said, it's no fun sitting over there. That's for damn sure. I'm at a point now. Long pause. He's the coach. He does the subbing. I just start taking what the defense gives me. But I couldn't do much on the bench. That's not my job. Sitting over there, but I can deal with it, said Carl. When you look back to this 91-92 season, these little items continue to just bounce up every few weeks. From Brad Rock, who was the Deseret News beat reporter for that 91-92 season's perspective, it was just guys living together.
I always took it. You're with those guys every single day for 7 or 8 months. That it's a spat that you have with your family. Blue had that thing with Jerry, and I do remember, if you remember his, he had that demeanor, he had that scowl, he looked really scary. And I got on a plane and was on the same flight with the team. They flew commercial flights, and we flew over to Denver, and Blue was standing over by himself by the luggage. I walked over and I said, Blue, can you talk a minute? He goes, sure, Brad, what do you need? And surprised me, he said, what happened with you and Jerry? And he kind of played that off, said it was, you know, nothing. It's just in the heat of the moment. So, yeah, I think it goes on all season with all teams, most seasons with all teams, that these things are going to pop up.
Salt Lake Tribune beat writer Steve Loom, who documented all of these previously mentioned stories in the Salt Lake Tribune archives, says he thought it was something that maybe this team needed.
I thought that the Jazz almost thrived on that kind of stuff. Carl would say something, and Jerry would use it as, okay, you guys take it over. I'm leaving, and I'm leaving practice, and you guys figure it out. And I always thought that was one thing that Jerry Sloan did really well, was common sense and judge when his voice was needed and when it wasn't. I also thought it was a tremendous strength of Stockton and Malone. Stockton and Malone, they had the locker room. I mean, those. If you came in and decided to play for the Jazz and were playing for the Jazz, when Stockton and Malone talked, you had to listen.
Assistant coach Phil Johnson remembers Jerry storming out of a practice here or there, all part of the technique of how to keep guys going for 82 games.
A lot of times, timeouts, he just wouldn't say anything. Stuff like that, you know. He'd just sit there and look at him. I mean, it was, yeah, he'd do different things. And so it's all part of the game.
And from the player's perspective at the time, the wily veteran, Mark Eaton, who was 35 years of age at that point, he'd seen it before. He knew what was going on, and he knew what Jerry wanted.
I remember some of that. And Jerry was always very concerned about having everybody's respect and everybody on the team. And he challenged Carl in the locker room a couple of times. And, you know, I can remember those. I can remember some of those moments. And, you know, and Jeff Malone had played on a couple of other teams before he came to the Jazz. He was a great scorer, but I could see him saying that kind of stuff. And Blue Edwards was a young player and great athlete. I loved to run the floor. But you know, he played that position of that, you know, big guard or that two guard small forward kind of guy. And Jerry just, you know, couldn't stand it if somebody in that position wasn't playing defense as he would have done it. And so there was, we had a few blow-ups like that.
After the back-to-back losses in San Antonio and Houston and Jerry Sloan storming out of practice, the Portland Trailblazers were in town on the 21st of March. The Jazz were 44-23. The Blazers were 48-19, four games ahead. Tyrone Corbin would have 13 points and 12 rebounds, but it was David Benoit, who the year before had played in Spain, had gone to Jazz camp, left Jazz camp, gone to Laker camp, sprained an ankle, didn't make the team, had to go play in Spain. The Jazz picked him up in summer league, who's beginning to find a rhythm. He had 12 points. Blue Edwards had 11. Eric Murdoch had the backup point guard job at the time, had 8, and the Jazz buried the Blazers, 95-77. Sloan said afterwards, Benoit, terrific. Murdoch, terrific. All those guys pumped us up. They worked hard. They ran the floor. Portland stroked us right in the middle of the bleachers at the start of the game, but those guys gave us a lift. Yeah, that's right. They stroked us right into the bleachers at the start of the game. Another great Sloanism along the way. The Jazz actually turned the corner in that game with John Stockton, Blue Edwards, Ty Corbin, David Benoit, and Mike Brown on the floor. A fairly small lineup that outscored the Blazers 19-5. And after the back-to-back losses and that win, the Jazz were back to a 2.5-game lead over the Spurs. The Jazz would beat the Sixers, lose to the Lakers, and beat the Bucks. But in the meantime, all of a sudden, San Antonio was falling apart. And the Jazz would move to a 5.5-game lead in the division. Stockton would turn 30. Karl Malone was past his test to drive trucks. That's right, the VIP kind of trucking, said Carl. We'll deliver your potatoes, your frozen foods, or whatever at a fair price. It's not $1.25 per mile, Malone admits. I'll make deliveries myself. If I'm not driving the truck, it's not going to be driven. Malone calls this a dream come true. Growing up as a little boy, I've always dreamed of owning my 18-wheeler. I remember riding with my mom and seeing him on the road and telling her, I'm going to own one of those someday. You can do it, she'd say. And now all of a sudden, here I am. Malone finished up saying, being on the road, there's a power to it. There's a smell to it. A clean diesel truck that gives it a kind of aura. It's a power kind of feeling. The Jazz would end March with a trip to Seattle and Portland to see where they rank. And the Jazz would get blown out 122-103 by the Sonics. John Stockton, after the ballgame, says it turned into one of them. It's indicative of the way we've been playing the last couple of games. We got to find some answers. And Sloan said, we look like dish rags. I know guys have their up and downs, but I always have a tough time when guys don't come out and dig down real deep. Well, they've been whipped in the middle of the bleachers and they're dish rags. So all of a sudden, the fans are getting a bit nervous and they get blown out by the Blazers, 118-86. The Jazz have lost 3 of 4. That's when Karl Malone had his bad 10-point game. And the next test would be the Suns. And that was when Carl was not happy, but the Jazz would bust out of it with a 113-94 win. Mailman's second half was fabulous, and Jeff Malone would give Jeff Hornacek the fits. But the fan base was not comfortable yet. In fact, if you read from the Salt Lake Tribune, as the calendar turned to April, there are two constants about the month of April: paying taxes and the Jazz taxing the patience of their faithful. In another article, winners at least one game against the five teams in the league with a better record and owners of the best mark, the Jazz receive little acclaim for being one of the top teams who'll be playing in June or beyond mid-May. But that's because during the winter, when the Jazz have played like world champs, they beat the Bulls, Blazers, Cavs, etc., and yet there have been times when they've played like the world chumps, said Dick Rosetta in the Salt Lake Tribune. The Jazz would have a chance to wrap up the division with three easy games, Minnesota, Denver, and Dallas, and of course they would promptly collapse to Minnesota. In 14-60 on the year, the Jazz led it by 15 and then fell apart. Steve Loom wrote after the game, if the Jazz subscribed to one magazine, it would likely be Psychology Today. This team has so many personalities. So the Jazz had lost five straight on the road, 4 of 6 overall. Jeff Malone after the game said, "We're not a very good team right now. I don't know why we should come in and beat a team like Minnesota. We need games like this. They're important, but we're not getting the job done." But that would be the last of the low moments. The Jazz would go on to win the Midwest Division for the first time since 1989. They would blow out the Mavs 113-90 and cruise the rest of the way, and they would head to the playoffs on a high note.
They were crushing teams. I mean, they beat the Nuggets by 20-something, 23, 24 points. Same thing with Dallas. I think they beat the Warriors. I think they beat the Warriors by about 40, way down the stretch. So their confidence was high. And I think at that point, the Jazz said, we don't have to take a back seat anymore. We're not coming hat in hand, grateful to be in the playoffs. We're going to go for it, and we're going to do something.
The Jazz were a maturing team, and they had lost in the playoffs. And Larry Miller, to his credit, kept Sloan. Sloan was able to become someone that Stockton and Malone and Eaton and those guys respected and wanted to play for. If he hadn't, who knows? If they had gone to Larry Miller and said, "We don't want Jerry Sloan," who knows what Larry would have said? But I think there was a unanimous support there.
And at the core of this entire season was Jerry Sloan's development and the team's connection with Jerry.
He had such a feel for the players. And I learned so much from him because I did not play in the league. I coached for all those years and everything, but I learned so much from him because he had a player's aspect or perspective of the game. And so he had an idea of how to communicate with the players. And he developed such a respect from the players, and we respected them. There was a mutual respect that I think that's really what was the most astounding thing about over the years. And then the other thing about Jerry that very people don't realize is how good he was at game management. I'm talking about timeouts, utilizing the clock, utilizing calling plays, substitutions. He was really good at that. And so I don't recall ever not having a timeout at a crucial time to move the ball up the floor if we needed to after a timeout. You know, and the players respect that, and they respect how he treated them and how much he respected what they did.
So it was on to the playoffs, the Larry Brown-led upstart L.A. Clippers, but not before a multi-day stretch that no one will ever forget. Today's show is brought to you in part by Murdoch Hyundai. I got to be honest, I got this email last night, and I actually then went car shopping. Like, the deals and the offers that are out there right now are so incredible. 0% for 84 months, and no payments until January. That's right. No payments until January. Those are some of the deals that are out there right now in these unprecedented times. So Murdoch Hyundai wants to help you and your family and wants you to have peace of mind, which is why Murdoch Hyundai is offering 0% for 84 months on new 2020 Elantra and Tucson, plus no payments until January of 2021. My daughter turned 16 in February. I was like, why? We should do this now. That's 6 years of no interest and 8 months of no payment on a brand new Murdoch Hyundai 2020 Elantra or 2020 Tucson. I was looking at it for a long time last night. I'm not making this up. This is truly, like, these deals are so good that I took the time to look at it. So if you're interested, going to Murdoch in Murray at 4646 South State Street or in Linden or in Logan, email me at dlock09@gmail.com. We can set it up. They also still have the program where they bring it to you. You can do all your shopping online, and then they'll bring the car to you for a test drive. It's remarkable what Hyundai is doing for you. No payments for till 2021, January of 2021, and 6 years of no interest. Murdoch Hyundai, 4646 South State Street. Also located in Logan and in Linden. Today's show is also brought to you by our good friends at InterCap Lending. That's Steve Carter and the crew at InterCap. InterCap, I still just love the whole mentality of InterCap. When I sent an email to Brock and said, hey, you know, in these times, what do you want me to tell people? And they said, like, he said, well, tell people to support their local restaurants, to give to the Red Cross, and to help any medical workers in any way they can. And I was like, okay, but I was looking for, like, things for your company. And he was like, that's irrelevant. But let me tell you, Steve Carter's there for you, because right now might be the right time for you to refinance or do a loan. InterCap Lending is done fabulous work, major growth, because they get deals done. And Steve Carter is our personal lending officer at InterCap. You can call him at 385-800-8528. Dave Thurman, all I can say is Steve Carter's by far the best loan officer I've ever worked with. And that is saying something, because I've done a fair share of loans in my lifetime. He was responsive, just down-to-earth person I've worked with, which is rare. I will recommend him to anyone I know with the highest praise. Clayton and Sarah Winslow, same thing. Steve Carter and InterCap did a fantastic job with a refi for Sarah and I. The process was seamless and very quick. The reviews are endless. The lockdown people have been helped are endless. So let Steve Carter help you right now if it's right. 385-800-8528, InterCap Lending, NMLS number 190465. Go to intercaplending.com for more information. And make sure you tell Steve Carter you were Locked On Jazz to get the Locked On Jazz corporate discount. As the playoffs got underway in 1991-92, the playoff failures of the past lingered. Larry Brown, who had been the head coach of the San Antonio Spurs, who beat the Jazz for the Midwest Division by a game each of the last 2 years, was now the head coach of the Los Angeles Clippers, who the Jazz would play in the first round. Don Nelson's Warriors, George Karl's Sonics, were sitting in the background waiting for round number two. And on the other side of the bracket were the Suns and Blazers, the two teams that had knocked the Jazz out of the playoffs the previous two seasons. But it felt a little different. The Jazz had won 17 of 20 heading down the stretch. Bad news came across the Jazz as they were getting ready for the playoff series, as David Benoit, the rookie's father, became ill. And David had to leave the team briefly. He would rejoin the team, but that would be a playoff-long issue. And there were enough sideshows between the Jazz and the Clippers to make you forget about any of the playoff failures. Ron Harper, before the series, said, I'm not going to get into Karl Malone, all-star, getting all the calls. And Olden Polony said, Carl talks a lot of beat. If he can get away with it, he's going to keep doing it. If he wants to talk, I'll talk. If he wants to fight, I'll fight. That's how he plays, through intimidation. Karl Malone called Olden Polony a loser. Game one, the Ghosts of Playoff Pass never had a chance, and neither did the LA Clippers, is how Steve Loom opened his article in the Salt Lake Tribune. Malone had 32, Jeff Malone had 29, and John Stockton notched 21 assists. A 22-4 run in the third. The crowd was crazy at the Delta Center, and the Jazz led it 81-54 through three onto a 115-97 win. Game two, the Clippers came with a physical presence, a flagrant early by Polonese. James Edwards and Karl Malone got tangled up, but it was Ty Corbin, who played 34 minutes in game one, played 38 minutes in game two, leading Doc Rivers, the then point guard for the Clippers, to say after, Tyrone Corbin's the best transaction of the year by any team. That move alone should win someone GM of the year. It was 8 points and 10 rebounds from Corbin that led the Jazz. The Clippers actually led that game at the half by eight, but Mark Eaton's defense spurred an 8-0 run to tie it at 48, and then John Stockton, 21 point and 19 assists despite early foul trouble. Ron Harper, after the game, sounded pleased. We made them beat us. We gave them game one, but in game two, they played hard. The series would shift to Southern California, playing out of the Sports Arena. The Clippers would notch their first playoff win since 1976. Jeff Malone turned his ankle late in game two and was not very good in game three, going 5 of 15. And the Clippers led by 5 at the end of one. The Jazz scored just 4 points in the final, 4-18, with Stockton out of the game in that first quarter. The season-long issue of the backup point guard rearing its ugly head, as neither Eric Murdoch or Delaney Rudd were playing in games at that point. Clippers led by 11 at the half, as the Jazz still couldn't score. They led by 16 with 10 minutes left, and the party was over that night for Utah. And little did we know what was going to happen next.
Jury in the Rodney King case has delivered its verdict, and not one of the four police officers seen on videotape beating Mr. King a year ago is guilty of using excessive force. They've all been found not guilty.
Chief Gates has put aside $1 million fund to pay for overtime for 1,000 police officers who have been placed on alert following this verdict. Peter?
Judith, you know your city pretty well. The fact that those police officers have been put on alert anticipates a reaction to a not guilty verdict?
I don't think there's much doubt that there's going to be quite a reaction. I think this was a stunning verdict.
I feel that it's a great travesty of justice. I feel that the jury in Simi Valley gave the okay to continue to abuse and oppress and suppress black people in this country. I feel that there is an undercurrent of racism and that the system is rotten to the core.
The violence erupted after the acquittal of four white policemen in the beating trial of black motorist Rodney King. There's been looting, buildings have been set ablaze, and some motorists have been dragged from their cars and beaten. So far, 9 people are reported dead, scores of others have been injured, and Governor Pete Wilson has declared a state of emergency today, Thursday, April the 30th.
Jazz assistant coach Phil Johnson remembers it all breaking loose.
Well, that's the most incredible experience ever. We're up 2-1. All of a sudden, the next day, the riots start. And we are in L.A. We're staying at a Marriott, and we're in Marina del Rey. So we're away from it, but we know what's going on because you can hear sirens going on. And you're basically quarantined at your hotel. You simply can't leave. And so all the news about the riots and so forth, and that was a very – and so the sports arena was kind of where they brought the National Guard in and so forth, the police forces in to organize to combat that. And so here we are stuck in a hotel. We can't practice. We can't go anyplace.
The verdicts are a moment where anyone who lived in Los Angeles or was in Los Angeles remembers exactly where they were and knew what was coming next. In fact, let me insert myself in the story for a moment. I was a 21-year-old intern at Prime Ticket Television in Century City. The verdicts came down, and immediately the president of Prime Ticket came over the loudspeaker and announced that everyone should go home immediately unless they were working on that night's specific broadcast and had to be there, to return home immediately to safety because we all knew what was happening next. And that panic was obvious everywhere across the city. And Steve Loom and Craig Bolajak remember exactly that.
The Jazz were going to have their afternoon press conference. Between games, the camera people were all set up in a room at that hotel. All of a sudden, everybody starts breaking down their cameras, running out the door. And I said, what's going on? And one of the cameramen said, the Rodney King verdict came in.
I went in to do the editing, which I love to do. And I filed a report and I was going to do a live stand-up. And as I was getting done, news anchor came to me and said, you know what, Bowler, you better get out of here. The fact that the decision was coming down just momentarily. And I remember sensing in the newsroom the panic.
Southern California native Mark Eaton decided that there had to be some sort of escape to keep the guys sharp and not too wound up.
In fact, I rented a car and I said, well, hey, let's just go. I think I took John Stock and Tyrone Corbin. We went down to Orange County because I said, nobody's on the freeways now. I mean, I'm from L.A. I'm like, I'm not too worried about it. I know it's everything is coming apart at the seams, but I'm like, the freeways will be fine. So I rented a car. We went down to Orange County and had a little house down there then. And we went to dinner and hung out for a few hours just to get out of the hotel because we were all going stir crazy. And then they finally decide, okay, we're going to play game 4 at the Anaheim Convention Center, which really wasn't a quote-unquote basketball arena. It was just kind of, they had some stands and a small little arena over there. And then, of course, it was just a crazy time. We had an armed escort from Marina del Rey over down the 91 to Anaheim.
And Craig Bolajak remembers that supplies were getting a bit limited.
That the hotel had not been able to have any type of deliveries over the last 3 days. So the menu was basically peanut butter, French fries, and some chicken fingers. I mean, that was basically what was left in the kitchen after 3 days.
The stories and the memories are still sharp. We'll hear them next from those involved as we continue on the 1991-92 Utah Jazz season, the most pivotal of them all. Today's show is brought to you in part by Sunprint Solutions. Sarah over at Sunprint Solutions has got an unbelievable company, right, that is Utah-owned, women-owned since 2019, established in 1941, and then rebranded as Sunprint Solutions in 2014. It is a Utah company through and through. They help all sorts of people, whether it's University of Utah with brochures and flyers, OC Tanners with booklets and certifications, Ancestry.com with the boxes and brochures for the DNA kits, LDS Church with books and stitchers, stickers, not stitchers, and Kaiser Permanente, all sorts of people. They do great work across the board, and they, Sunprint Solutions, has found a way in the current environment to keep up and running. So right now is not the time to drop all of your printing, your marketing, and all of those things. You need to make sure that your company is up and running and reaching people. Direct mail has become even more important right now than ever before. So Sunprint Solutions is there for you. They've got three buildings, 68 stage shifts to make sure that they have appropriate social distancing. They have 20 of their employees that work remotely now, and the other 66 work in various shifts. It's innovative businesses get things done right now. Give Sarah a call at 801-978-5601. That's 801-978-5601. They can print folding carton boxes, flyers, brochures, books, mailers, folders, coupons, much, much more. Call Sarah at Sunprint Solutions, 801-978-5601. The Jazz would try to get back to normalcy, and that's when they realized things were not normal.
Oh, it was insane because, like you said, we had won the two games. We went down there. We were staying at the Marriott at Marina Del Rey. And, I think that we'd played one game at the sports arena already, right? And we were waiting. And it was game four we were waiting for. In between game three and four is when they announced the Rodney King verdict, and the whole town just cut loose. And then we ended up sitting there for like 3 days, and you could see smoke in the distance and fire. And then one day we had practice over and actually in Inglewood on Manchester Boulevard there at Inglewood High School. And as we pulled up there, we had security, and then there was a dozen police cars went by, lights and siren, and there was some big incident down at the next intersection. And we went and had some sort of a little practice, but we didn't hang around very long. We spent most of the time in the hotel.
The Jazz, the off-day practice, they went to Inglewood High, which is right on the fringe of the worst of the areas. And you could, the police cars kept going up and down Manchester, and the smoke was rising in the not, literally a few blocks away. And they let the Jazz in the Inglewood High, the gymnasium, from the street. And there were several reporters, we weren't allowed into practice, especially during the playoffs. And we were outside, and we're sitting on the step, and we're all looking at each other. Nobody's saying anything, but everybody's kind of saying, is this where we want to be? And a minute later, the door opens, and the security guard opens the door, and he says, Coach says you guys should watch, should come in and watch practice inside. And we went in, guy rechained the door with a deadbolt lock, and we were able to watch practice. And goes to Jerry's common sense. He knew that it wasn't the safest place, and there were a lot of reporters who were very thankful to not be sitting on the steps, because it was L.A. that morning, that afternoon, was a very dangerous place.
They had the media ride with the team on the team bus, so we weren't in trouble driving cars down in there, and they practiced at Inglewood High School, and they had police officers watching as you got off the team bus, and then you walked into the gym, and they padlocked the gym doors and had armed guards outside the basketball arena. So it was a real crazy, distracting time.
Longtime Utah sportscaster Wesley Ruff was at ABC at the time as a young man. He would head down to Southern California to cover the series for the Jazz and the Clippers. And he would have a life experience that he would never forget, and one of the most terrifying moments of his life.
I'm doing a live shot on the roof on the early show on our 5:30. I think it was 5:30 back then. I was doing a live shot on the roof of KCOP, our sister station. And I get done. So I'm on the roof, and you can see the whole city burning behind me. And we get done, and I toss back to our anchors, Randall Carlisle and Kimberly Perkins. And I say, you know, that's Wesley Ruff live in Los Angeles. And Kimberly says to me, "Hey, Wes, is it scary there?" In one of my great moments, I think, I look over my shoulder at all the smoke and I said, "Yeah, see all this smoke behind me, Kimberly? These are not barbecues gone awry. This city is burning." And it was just like people in Utah had no, you know, they weren't close to it, so they had no concept of what it was like. But it was just, it was so bizarre. Right after we got done with that live shot on the roof, they shut KCOP down because the fires were getting closer there. We had another thing to edit for our 10 o'clock show. They sent us up to where Craig Wirth was editing up in Burbank. Craig Wirth was working for KMBC. And we asked if we could edit at his place. And he said, "Sure." So he told us how to get there. We didn't have GPS. We didn't have cell phones back then. And he told me, and I still remember the streets to take. It was La Brea, Cahuenga, Orange, Olive. And I think there was one, La Brea. There was, anyway, he told me I had to take all these different streets. Got up there, edited, got done, fed it, and back to the station in Salt Lake. And we're getting ready to leave. And Craig said, "Hey, are you headed back?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Look at this." And we watched the TV. And they said, "All right, we have more street closures to announce because of the riots and fires. Cahuenga, La Brea, Olive, Orange, all of the streets that we just taken were all now shut down because of the riots." And then the next day was the worst ever for me. They split us up. We went to jazz practice, and then I edited, had to meet the satellite truck and our photographer, Kurt, at the police station in South Central L.A., and they told me how to get there from Marina Del Rey. And I'm in a Hertz rental car. And back then they used to have the Hertz stickers on the car. And I'm in a little Geo Metro with a big Hertz sticker on it. And they said, "Okay, just go up the freeway and then you turn on Arlington Boulevard and you go 30 blocks straight and you'll run right into the police headquarters." I'm like, "Great." So it's like 15 minutes after curfew. There's hardly anybody out on the freeway. As I'm driving, and as soon as they turn off on Arlington Boulevard, I get this sick feeling like, "This is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. I shouldn't even be here." I passed three buildings that were on fire. One of them had lit a car on fire and driven it into the building to set the building on fire. And the fire department wasn't coming down there because that was the Crenshaw. That was like, you know, that was ground zero for the riots. And I'm just like, "What am I doing here in this place?" And so I'm driving down the road and I'm counting the blocks. I'm like, "Okay, I got 26 more blocks. I got 25 more blocks. I got 24 more blocks." And I come about halfway there. It's two lanes each way. I come to a stoplight and me, Mr. Civil Obedience, I stop. And I'm waiting at the stoplight like, "Please change, please change, please change." And a car pulls up to the side of me with four guys in it. And then they turn and they get right in front of me and they tee me. So I can't move. They're blocking me. So our cars are a T. And the driver looks at me and says, "What the f*** are you doing here?" And I thought I was dead. I thought, this is where I died. And there was no helicopter flying above to you know, film me getting drug out of the car and beaten to death. And we didn't have cell phones back then. And I just thought, my wife's not going to know what happened to me. Station's not going to know. Kurt's not going to know. I'm going to die here. And it was like the scariest moment of my life. And people always ask me what happened. Well, I don't know. And I couldn't tell you then what happened. I remember getting to police headquarters. So I don't know if the light changed and I went around them. I don't know if they kept going. I don't know. But I made it to police headquarters eventually. And the beauty part of that story is I get there and they had it barricaded a block away, and a cop stops me and says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I need to get to those satellite trucks to do a live shot." And he said, "Do you have any credentials?" And I'm like, "I'm covering the jazz game. I don't have any media credentials." And so I open my wallet and I pull out the Utah High School Activities Association press pass that barely gets me into high school basketball games here in Utah or football games. I show him the pass. He goes, "Okay, go ahead." And he won't even So we get there and Kurt's like, "I tried to call you at the hotel to tell you not to come down here. It's too scary, blah, 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 blah." And we're about 2 minutes away from our live shot and a snipe. So we're there. WGN is there, CNN, CBS, and everybody's lined up doing live shots and everyone is in bulletproof vests except us. And we're about 2 minutes away from our live shot. So it's about just a little before 10 o'clock Salt Lake time, a little before 9 o'clock LA time. and a sniper in the building kitty corner from us takes two shots at all the TV lights. And instantly we just, you know, we're on the ground and the gates fly open from the police headquarters, and 50 cops come out pumping shotguns, and they're screaming at us to turn off our lights. And so we're pulling plugs on the lights and crawling like army style back to the satellite truck. And I ended up doing my live shot in the doorway of the satellite truck. But by that time we're like, geez, just shoot me, put me out of my misery. Cause it was just so intense and so scary. Got back to the hotel that night. All the jazz players and the media were just hanging around in the Marina Del Rey Marriott, in the lounge. And I remember Steve Loom saying, geez, Wes, what happened? You're white as a ghost. And I said, we just got shot at. He's like, seriously though, what's wrong? And I said, we just got shot at.
I'm not far from Wesley Ruff, our broadcast associate partner over at Channel 4. He actually, both of us were asked to put flak jackets on. And he actually was shot at by a sniper. We were yelled at by the California Highway Patrol in a chopper. I'll never forget this. That was hovering above us. And at that time, we didn't understand the real severity, but had a flak jacket on for safety because there was a lot of shooting going on in the city. But we had a light on to light up the live shot, and they used a speaker system, whatever, from above. Turn off your light. Turn off your light.
In the midst of all this madness, these scary times, an entire society erupting and exploding, it took to Frank Layden to get everyone to laugh a little. Craig Bowlerjack remembers fondly.
The one moment of levity was the great Frank Layden, David, where in the hotel room, I think on night three, we had the National Guard and a tank out in front of the hotel, and had National Guard snipers on top of our hotel room. And Frank calls up to all the media that were staying there, and he goes, this is Frank, Barbara, and I are inviting you all to the Last Supper. And I just laughed because what he did was he brought us together to talk. He had anybody drank wine, you had to buy, he got you a bottle. If you had Diet Coke, he'd bring you, they'd bring you a whole bottle of Diet Coke. But he gave us a chance to kind of get away from the unknown. It was fearful. We thought it'll be a long time before we get out of Los Angeles because, again, fires were being set, by the second, by the minutes. And we just talked about good, fun stories. I have to tip my hat to Frank, God love him, who really put a very stressful moment and gave us a moment of levity. In fact, maybe about an hour where we actually just sit around.
On the next episode of the 1991-92 Utah Jazz season, the most pivotal of them all, we'll get on the floor for the playoff run, which will include a game that may have been more important than any other, the exact moment and where the pivot happened. Plus, Mark Eaton reminds everyone his value, and a poke in the eye ends all hope. It's all coming up on the 1991-92 Utah Jazz season, the most pivotal of them all.